Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, September 23rd. Court orders new trial for Clinton Young. The death row inmate was convicted by a Midland County jury in 2003. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals on Wednesday tossed a capital murder conviction and granted a new trial for Clinton Lee Young, the death row inmate who was convicted by a Midland County jury in 2003. Young was sentenced to death for killing Doyle Douglas, age 41, and Samuel Petrie, age 52, for the use of their vehicles during a 48-hour crime spree. Petrie was kidnapped in his hometown of Eastland and killed in an oil field near Midland. The appeals court overturned Young's conviction because of a revelation that then-Assistant District Attorney Ralph Petty, who helped prosecute Young, was also moonlighting as a judicial clerk for the same trial, according to an opinion filed Wednesday. From 2002 until he retired in 2019, Petty was paid at least $132,900 by multiple district judges to work as a clerk on cases that he was also helping to prosecute, according to court documents. Quote, "The evidence presented in this case supports only one legal conclusion, that applicant was deprived of his due process rights to a fair trial and an impartial judge," the court wrote. Evidence that was shown during a Zoom hearing demonstrated that Petty worked as a judicial clerk on habeas corpus cases while he was working full-time for the district attorney's office. Former Midland County District Attorneys Al Shorey and Teresa Klingman allegedly knew of Petty's dual role. Although Petty did not serve as a primary prosecutor during Young's trial, he was an active member of the prosecution team, drafting motions, appearing in court, and acting as a legal advisor for the prosecution, the court documents state. Current Midland County District Attorney Laura Nodolf, who was elected in 2016, discovered in 2019 that Petty had worked as a judicial clerk when she was reviewing department invoices. The district attorney's office then recused itself from Young's case and sent notices to about 300 defendants to inform them of the ethical conflict. Young's lawyers filed to overturn his conviction in 2020 with the new information about Petty. It was the fourth time his lawyers submitted writs of habeas corpus. Petty was paid $16,700 for his work as a judicial clerk in Young's case through 2003, in addition to his salary with the district attorney's office, according to the court documents. He represented the state of Texas during Young's first appeal hearing, while he was also being paid to do clerk work for the judge presiding over the trial. Quote, "This combined evidence demonstrates that, in his role as prosecutor, Petty opposed habeas relief at the writ hearings, while at the same time, in his role as a judicial clerk to Judge John Hyde, he drafted the order recommending the denial of Young's initial writ application," the appeals court wrote. The court concluded that, quote, "judicial and prosecutorial misconduct in the form of an undisclosed employment relationship between the trial judge and prosecutor appearing before him tainted Young's entire proceeding from the outset. As a result, little confidence can be placed in the fairness of the proceedings or the outcome of Young's trial. The taint, the record shows, continued through Young's post-conviction proceedings and persisted until the revelation in 2019 of Perry's judicial employment upon inadvertent discovery by District Attorney Nodolf," end quote. Petty did not testify at the appeals hearing after invoking his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. He surrendered his law license in April in lieu of disciplinary action. Young will be transported to the custody of the Midland County Sheriff's Office to await a new trial. MISD looks to prove itself. District officials are calling Intercession Week MISD Achieves. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. If you talk to new Midland ISD Associate Superintendent Charlie Garcia, it is easy to hear that he sees opportunities where others might not. Star tests? While many see them as an unfair assessment and a punishment for teachers and students, he sees them as an opportunity for a school district on the rise to show how much improvement has taken place. The same can be said for intercession, which are the weeks built into the Midland ISD calendar that weren't unanimously endorsed by the school board or the community. Whether citing an unfair burden put on teachers, students, or families, some believe the calendar change wasn't what was best for the Midland community. Garcia disagrees. As a former principal in the Socorro and Isleta districts inside the El Paso metropolitan area, he has experienced the opportunity that intercession has allowed. The opportunity, he said, is for students to get back on track, to be positively impacted by more attention with teachers, and to take advantage of enrichment offerings. That, he said, will be the case October 18th through 21st, when Midland ISD takes part in its first intercession week. Midland ISD officials are trying to dub the week MISD Achieves, and what they are offering far exceeds to the reading-only curriculum that was once thought to be focus of intercession. The district reported the following this week. Intervention sessions in reading, math, English, and algebra to make sure all students are on track with their grade level. Enrichment programs like Go for Launch, a space-themed science program for 8th through 12th graders that will send one winning experiment to the International Space Station. Princeton Review SAT, PSAT prep for high school students, made possible by Diamondback Energy. The district reported Tuesday that Midland High students have already filled up their allotment of seats, but there is still room for Legacy High students. Some of the students participating in the intercession will be there voluntarily. Others will be required to be there based on academic performance issues. Campuses will inform parents if a student needs to be a part of the first intercession, the district reported this week. Participating elementary and junior high students will attend sessions for full days, while some high school students may only be required to attend for a half day. Garcia said the district has hired enough teachers, helped by incentives for those who want to be on campus. Either way, he said those students participating can expect smaller-scale classes and creative instruction that makes the week fun for students while still allowing them to learn. Quote, it is full steam ahead, Garcia said. Momentum, he said, will be built for the spring intercession and to prove to any doubters what intercession can do. Quote, some of the most successful schools in the region utilized an intercession period to help students, Garcia said of his time in El Paso. Continuing the quote, these students have been through a pandemic. We want to catch them up and promote their learning. End quote. The period, he said, can help provide a segue to success for that student that he might feel like he or she is behind. He also said it will help some of the district's premier educators to establish intercession as a useful tool for Midland, which has been ranked near the bottom of the largest school districts in the state. Garcia is new to the district, Superintendent Angelica Ramsey brought him on board this summer to help complete her leadership team. However, Garcia likes the talent on the campuses. He said there is no doubt teachers and principals will have a great deal of success at the end of the year. He said he wanted to thank the community for its patience and support of the district. And yes, he looks forward to star testing. Quote, "We are mobilizing to make Midland ISD a premier school district in a short amount of time," he said. ConocoPhillips becomes Permian's number two producer. The Houston-based company was previously ranked fourth. The story was written by Kevin Crowley of Bloomberg. ConocoPhillips' purchase of Royal Dutch Shell's PLC's Permian assets will make it the second largest producer in the world's top shale basin, according to data from Enverus. The Houston-based company was previously ranked fourth after buying Contra Resources Incorporated earlier this year, the data show. The shale deal is expected to be completed in the fourth quarter. Quote, "After waiting patiently on M&A opportunities through the land rush years of the shale boom, Conoco has been able to pick up prime Permian real estate at what looks to be attractive price points," said Andrew Dittmar, senior mergers and acquisitions analyst at Enverus. Occidental Petroleum Corporation lost its crown as the Permian's top producer after low oil prices and high debt levels forced the company to cut output last year. Chevron Corporation had been rising steadily up the rankings, but was overtaken by Pioneer Natural Resources Company this year after the company's purchase of Parsley Energy and private equity-backed DoublePoint.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, published Thursday, September 23rd, 2021, Business and Oil Page. Permian Deal Puts Giant's Focus to Test, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. ConocoPhillips has long stood out in the oil business for its conservative approach, ignoring the prevailing wisdom of growth at all costs in favor of modest spending, maintaining large cash reserves, and rewarding shareholders with ever larger dividends. The Houston oil giant's intense focus on capital discipline and shareholder returns is now being tested by its proposed $9.5 billion all-cash acquisition of Royal Dutch Shell's Permian business. The deal, which comes less than a year after ConocoPhillips put down $13.3 billion in stock to gobble up Midland-based Concho Resources, comes as the rest of the oil industry has widely adopted ConocoPhillips's capital discipline and returns-focused approach in the wake of the global pandemic. ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance, in a conference call with analysts Tuesday morning, defended the company's latest acquisition, arguing that the Permian wells and pipelines it is buying from Shell will help pay for larger shareholder dividends. At the same time the Shell deal was announced, ConocoPhillips increased its quarterly dividend to 46 cents per share from 43 cents and increased its disposition target by $2 billion. The company this year expects to return $6 billion, or about 8% of its company's market value of $79.5 billion, to shareholders. "We're walking the talk, you know. These aren't just words that are coming out of our mouth," Lance said Tuesday. "We're following exactly what we've told our shareholders and returning a significant amount of the capital back to our shareholders." ConocoPhillips' latest acquisition is a bold bet on the Permian Basin and the future of shale after the worst oil bust in a generation. When the deal closes, ConocoPhillips will strengthen its position as the largest independent oil and gas producer in the country and one of the biggest players in the Permian Basin of West Texas, the nation's top oil field. Shell's Permian assets include about 225,000 acres of non-federal land near ConocoPhillips' operations, as well as more than 600 miles of oil, natural gas, and water pipelines to support production. ConocoPhillips estimates that 2022 production from Shell's Permian assets will be about 200,000 barrels a day. Conoco is making a major commitment to shale in this deal, and in particular the Permian Basin, said Andrew Dittmar, senior mergers and acquisitions analyst at Austin-based research firm Enverus. That is an area that lagged in Conoco's portfolio for years, but has recently leapt to the forefront of its long-term plans. Unlike most energy deals since the pandemic, which have been funded largely or entirely with company shares, ConocoPhillips' deal with Shell is the largest all-cash exploration and production deal in 3 years, according to Enverus, an Austin-based energy research firm. All-stock deals, such as ConocoPhillips' deal with Concho, allow oil companies to acquire companies and assets without taking a hit to their balance sheet. ConocoPhillips, with its massive war chest built up during the shale boom, said it expects to have $4 billion on its balance sheet by the end of the year, even after paying for Shell's Permian assets. ConocoPhillips' Permian ambitions, however, come as industry giants have pledged to maintain austerity in an effort to woo back Wall Street investors burned by the industry's brash spending during the shale boom. While oil prices have returned to more than $70 a barrel, a level at which oil companies can make a healthy profit, oil giants remain restrained in their spending, instead focusing on returning cash to shareholders through higher dividends and share buybacks. ExxonMobil, the nation's largest and most profitable oil company, hasn't made a major acquisition since the pandemic, instead focusing on its profitable ventures in offshore Guyana and exploring carbon capture storage projects. For ConocoPhillips, the chance to pick up desirable Permian acreage at a bargain during the pandemic may have proved too alluring to pass up. ConocoPhillips will pay about $15,600 per acre for Shell's Permian land, a quarter of the nearly $60,000 an acre Occidental Petroleum paid for Anadarko's Permian position in 2019. Shell's acreage is also only slightly more expensive than what ConocoPhillips paid for Concho's Permian position this year, around $10,000 an acre, according to Enverus. After waiting patiently on mergers and acquisitions opportunities through the land rush years of the shale boom, Conoco has been able to pick up prime Permian real estate at what looks to be attractive price points, Dittmar said. Besides a general cooling in the market for shale acreage, Conoco's ability to pay cash in a deal of this size likely contributed to nabbing the assets at an attractive price point. Moreover, Shell is leaving its most productive acreage in the Permian for ConocoPhillips to develop, according to Allegra Dawes, an analyst at New York investment research firm Third Bridge. ConocoPhillips plans to continue to increase oil and gas production by about 3% annually. At the time that Shell put together its Permian portfolio, the best acreage lacked the necessary infrastructure, Dawes said. This leaves the buyer, in this case ConocoPhillips, with the opportunity to exploit the better properties. Goldman forecasts $90 oil if winter is colder than normal, by Alex Steele and Gerson Frevitas Jr., Bloomberg. Oil may surge to $90 a barrel if the approaching winter in the Northern Hemisphere proves colder than normal, said Jeff Currie, global head of commodities research at Goldman Sachs Groups Incorporated. Such a rise would be $10 higher than the bank's current forecast and would be accompanied by a prolonged period of high natural gas prices that already have had disastrous consequences for UK power providers. Tightening gas supplies in Europe will elevate demand for oil as an alternative at a time when global crude output is constrained, Currie said during a Bloomberg television interview on Wednesday. Post-hurricane disruptions in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico were among the worldwide factors he cited. Meanwhile, the gas rally shows no signs of abating, particularly outside the U.S., as tight supplies run headlong into surging demand, Currie said. Supply chains are so severely depleted that the system cannot accommodate any type of disruption, Currie said. Benchmark international oil futures rose 1.4% to $75.39 at 4:09 p.m. in London, extending the year-to-date advance to 46%. OPEC Nations Warn of Turbulence by Grant Smith and Anthony D. Pola, Bloomberg. As the global natural gas crunch hits suppliers and consumers alike, OPEC nations are warning of the knock-on impact for oil markets. Iraq expects higher demand for crude as the shortfall of gas forces consumers to look for alternative fuels, Oil Minister Ehsan Abdul Jabbar said on Wednesday. The head of Nigeria's state oil firm, Mel Kyari, predicted that petroleum demand could be boosted by 1 million barrels a day, with prices potentially gaining $10 a barrel over the next 6 months. While the two exporters are hardly neutral observers of the situation, their views echo thinking that's increasingly widespread in the market. Brent futures are already at $75 a barrel, approaching this year's peak. Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated says that a cold winter could overwhelm the oil market's capacity to make up for missing gas supplies, resulting in a price spike with repercussions for the economy. Almost 2 million barrels of oil a day could be needed for a mixture of power generation and industrial purposes, the bank said. In such an extreme scenario, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its partners could benefit handsomely as they still had plenty of crude supplies shuttered when the pandemic struck last year. It could be a particularly golden opportunity for Baghdad, which is eager to maximize sales after being hobbled by years of conflict. If there is an agreement within OPEC, we will be ready, Iraq's Jabbar said. Oil jumps as U.S. supplies deplete, by Sheila Tobin, Bloomberg. Oil advanced after U.S. crude inventories slid to the lowest levels since October 2018 and as broader markets gained. Futures in New York rose as much as 2.2% on Wednesday. Domestic crude stockpiles fell for a seventh straight week to about 414 million barrels, according to an Energy Information Administration report, signaling a rapidly tightening market. Meanwhile, U.S. equities surged as worries about China Evergrande Group's debts woes eased. The Chinese economic uncertainty is now easing, with Beijing moving to contain fears of a spiraling debt crisis at Evergrande, said Andrew LeBeau, senior partner at Commodity Research Group. Traders will also be watching the U.S. Federal Reserve's latest interest rate decision later Wednesday, with the potential timeline for tapering stimulus measures key for investors. Midland Reporter Telegram Opinion Page, Thursday, September 23rd. Opinion Extra. Why WLA issue will impact others at MISD? By Stuart Doreen, Editor. In a perfect world, the Young Women's Leadership Academy in Midland would have a new building, all the technology one could put in a classroom, and more space than it needed, just like every other school in Midland. The fact is, it doesn't, and for the second time this year, attention was brought to their conditions during a school board meeting. Young Women's Leadership Academy is an in-district partnership between Midland ISD and the Dallas-based Young Women's Preparatory Network. In this column, readers have seen major kudos sent to the district for its decision to make such a partnership a reality, just like the decision to partner with IDEA Public Schools. Both have a record of academic achievement. That should be the number one priority of the district. Young Women's Leadership Academy in Midland shares a campus with Jones Elementary in Southwest Midland, not a building, but land. Midland ISD has spent money for upgraded portables where many of the girls' classes and activities take place. It is not ideal, but people knew that when the school was first started. The hope for district leaders when the school was started in 2019 was that voters would approve a $569 million bond and YWLA would eventually be upgraded and take over a junior high campus. The bond failed. And when that happened, the district was caught in a tough situation. Plan B is not that easy. What district leaders are looking at is taking a campus in a part of town where growth isn't happening and considering moving those kids at that campus to another. This is an idea supported by some on the school board because, well, YWLA deserves better. Representatives of YWLA told us they want something done at the most recent school board meeting. They told us YWLA was one of the highest performing schools in the district. They told us students sometimes have to exit a building defenseless from the elements or exposed to the Southwest Midland neighborhood. In both cases, those appear to be very true statements. Those representatives also said that they were promised better digs than what they enjoy now. One speaker even said they were told their experience at YWLA would resemble what girls at the Hockaday School in North Dallas experience. Hockaday is one of the most expensive private schools in the state of Texas. Another comment made this week by a representative of the school was that YWLA deserved better because they are one of the top performing schools in the district and that its facilities should match its students' performance. I don't have a problem with the people at YWLA wanting better. Those students probably deserve better than an education at a portable school community. All students do. YWLA should have started like IDEA with its own building from day one. That didn't happen, and new MISD leadership is having to deal with this inherited situation. But I also offer this to those who represent YWLA. Please stop with the talk that you deserve your own campus more than other students inside the district. You don't. Please stop with the language that your facilities should reflect your performance. My guess is that Carver kids could make a similar argument, and I have never heard a peep from that campus. In my perfect world, someone donates a building that becomes the home of Young Women's Leadership Academy. That would be cool. It's also highly unlikely. What I expect will happen is that the students, like those who attend Jones Elementary, will be forced to another campus where there appears to be room for them. Then money will be spent to upgrade what will become the YWLA campus into one suitable for a secondary campus, including parking. Lastly, we lose the opportunity to upgrade them to a more proper campus at a later date. School district officials have said they expect the solution to the YWLA problem to happen by the end of the year. I can say, without a doubt, the end result will not remind anyone of Hockaday. Still, I hope those who have made it clear YWA deserves better, including those on the board, appreciate the sacrifices that took place to make better happen.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, September 23rd. Armando Ramirez Terran, age 69, of Midland, passed away on September 20th. Armando was born on July 15th, 1952, in El Mulato, Mexico, to Juvencio Ramirez and Catalina Terran. Armando was a loving husband and father. He is survived by his wife, Peggy Ramirez, daughters Linda Ramirez, Martha Ramirez, Veronica Ramirez, Rebecca Ramirez, stepdaughters Christina Escamilla, Erica Escamilla, sons Armando Ramirez Jr., Miguel Angel Ramirez, David Ramirez, Victor Antonio Ramirez, stepsons Antonio de Jesus Escamilla, Manuel Escamilla Jr., sisters Victorina Ramirez, Irene Ramirez, Rosa Talavera, Elvira Barron, Lupe Ramirez, brothers Reynaldo Ramirez, Elias Ramirez, Juvencio Ramirez Jr., 29 grandchildren, and 28 great-grandchildren. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home is honored to serve the Terran family at this time. May Beth Tryon, age 88, passed passed away Monday, September 13th, after a long battle with Alzheimer's. Viewing will be Saturday, September 25th, from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Mount Rose Baptist Church, 211 North Tyler Street, followed by services at 11 a.m. Pastor William C. Palmer will officiate. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. She is preceded in death by her husband, Barty Tryon Jr., in 2012. Survivors include her three children, Tori Tryon of Houston, Darren Tryon of Midland, and Tawana Tryon Ramsey of Marietta, Georgia, and four grandchildren. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Marvin Zug was born in Midland on September 19, 1976, to Marvin Zug Sr. and Peggy Hatfield. He passed away on September 15th. Marvin was preceded to death by all four grandparents, his father, Marvin Sr., in 1990, brother Randy in 2003, and his mother, Peggy, in 2017. Marvin is survived by his bonus dad, Tom Hatfield, and his sisters, Rose Rodriguez of Midland, Rhonda Wheat of Midland, Robin Paredes of La Mesa, Stacy Hatfield of Midland, and Angie Carrasco of South Bend, Indiana. Marvin is also survived by his nephews Rusty and Chase Savage, Corey and Cameron Murphy, TJ and Tanner Holt, Kason Coppage, Alicia Carrasco, and nieces Nicole Savage, Eliana, Alexia, and Gabby Carrasco, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. The family requests that in lieu of flowers or donations, that people would spend time with your family. Enjoy each and every moment with those you love. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home is honored to serve the family. Pedro Pete Borrego, age 75, of Midland, passed away peacefully at Midland Memorial Hospital on September 18th. Pete was born October 4th, 1945, to the late Anita Borrego and Pedro Borrego Sr. in Fabens, Texas. He is survived by his wife, Sylvia R. Borrego, his children, Melissa Villarreal and her husband, Frank Villarreal, Pete Borrego III, Rhonda Salgado and her husband, Gabriel Salgado, Augustin Borrego and his siblings, Ishmael Ramirez, Raul Borrego, Teofilo Borrego, Yolanda Heredia, Anita Hill, and Rachel Jordan. Pete was preceded in death by his parents, a sister Tina Gibbs, three brothers Fabian Ramirez, Joe Ramirez, and Nicholas Ramirez. In keeping with Pete's wishes, cremation services have been arranged. Online condolences can be made at asanchezTFH.com. Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home and Chapel is honored to serve the Borrego family at this time. Phil Macy Hinson, age 67 of Greenwood, passed away on September 20th. Phil was born on March 6, 1954, to Herschel and Mildred Hinson in Hops, New Mexico. Phil met the love of his life and his soulmate, Pat, in government class at Lovington High School. They married after graduation on August 4, 1972, and shared 49 years together. Phil and Pat raised three children and enjoyed every moment with their seven grandchildren. Phil is survived by his wife, Pat, two sisters, Gail Hinson and Marshall Welch, daughter Stacy and husband Todd Jones of Midland, son Austin and wife Kendra of Andrews, and son Kelsey and wife Tara of New Home. The family suggests memorials to lungtransplantfoundation.org. Funeral services will be at the Stanton Baptist Church in Stanton, Texas at 10 a.m. on Thursday, September 23rd. Graveside services will follow in Antioch, New Mexico. Visitation will be at Gilbreth Funeral Home in Stanton at 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, September 22nd. Arrangements are under the direction of Gilbreth Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Victoria Ann Kern, age 57, passed away on Thursday, September 16th, at Baylor Scott and White Hospital in Grapevine, Texas. She was born on January 18, 1964, in Fort Worth, to James Lawson Upham and Patricia Elaine Upham. Victoria grew up in Midland, Texas. She graduated from Midland High School in 1982. Victoria was preceded in death by her mother, Patricia Upham. Those left to cherish Victoria's memories are her husband, Jim Kern, daughter, Brenna Martin, and husband, Sawyer, son, Dalton Kern, granddaughter, Avery, father, James Upham, and wife, Susan, brother, Robert Upham, father-in-law, William G. Kern, and wife, Patricia, brothers-in-law, David Kern and Douglas Kern, sister-in-law, Kathleen Kern, nephews, Michael and wife, Lena, Danny, Alex, and niece, Megan. A celebration of life service will be held at Emerald Hills Funeral Home in Kennedale, Texas, on Thursday, September 23rd. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorial donations be made to Shelter to Rescue, www.shelter2rescue.org, or the American Cancer Society. Cameron Douglas Combs was born on August 7, 2002, in Odessa, Texas. On September 14th of 2021, he passed away on September 14th of this year. Cameron is preceded in death by his great-grandfather, Jimmy Rance Stroud, and uncles Dean Anderson and Darren Uncle Ugg Anderson. He is survived by his mother, Brittany Hennessy, and husband Ryan, father Caleb Combs and wife Tara, sister Mackenzie, as well as great-grandmother Doris Winnell Stroud, maternal grandparents Lyndia Anderson and Gregory Morris, paternal grandparents Diane and Dean Combs, and numerous aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, September 25th, at the station on Mercer in Dripping Springs, Texas, from 10:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. Brandon Blake Barger, age 19, of Midland, passed away on September 19th. Rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. on Friday, September 24th, at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Memorial Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, September 25th, at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Survivors include parents Elaine and Jeffrey Barger and sister Savannah. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Jacob Wiebe, age 58, passed away on September 19th. A viewing was held on Tuesday, September 21st, and Wednesday, September 22nd, at Rylander Church in Grady, Texas. Funeral services will be held on Thursday, September 23rd, at the Rylander Church in Grady. Burial will follow at Rylander Cemetery. Survivors include his wife, Maria Wiebe, mother, Elizabeth Wiebe, sons, Wilhelm Wiebe, Johann Wiebe, Jacob Wiebe, Klaus Wiebe, Peter Wiebe, daughter, Elizabeth Dyke, one sister, three brothers, and 24 grandchildren. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.stantonfh.com. Maria Elena Garcia Natividad, age 84, of Odessa, passed away on September 17th at Madison Medical Resort in Odessa, Texas. Maria was born on December 6, 1936, to Jose and Guadalupe Carrasco in Mexico. She is survived by one daughter, Bertha Mendoza, three grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, and two sisters. Visitation was held on Wednesday, September 22nd. A rosary was held also on that day at American Heritage Funeral Home. Funeral services will be on Thursday, September 23rd at 2 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home. Burial will take place at American Heritage Cemetery.
Hi, I'm Kim, reading the Odessa American. Today is Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. City's mass vaccination ends Friday. The City of Odessa's mass COVID-19 vaccination clinic will be discontinued as of 1 p.m. Friday after a total of 66 people showed up Monday and Tuesday to be vaccinated. Fire Rescue Assistant Fire Chief Rod Huber announced Wednesday. The outdoor clinic, which was held in the University of Texas Permian Basin parking lot, was a joint effort by the city, UTPB, and the Ector County Health Department. "We can't justify the resources being used for this effort," Huber said. "We tried. It is what it is." Odessa's Director of Communications, Devin Benavides, said 51 people were vaccinated on Tuesday, 15 on Wednesday. Benavides said if the FDA this week approves booster shots for the general public, the vaccination effort will likely continue. "Everything is kind of fluid," Benavides said. "The low turnout so far this week is likely due to several factors, including some residents' continued reluctance to get vaccinated," Huber said. "Residents also have many options where they can get vaccinated, including pharmacies and clinics. We were the only game in town when the city held a similar event at Ratliff Stadium, where thousands of people received their first vaccinations in February and March," Huber said. Organizers of this latest effort were hopeful that the FDA was going to approve Pfizer booster shots for the general public last week, but that didn't happen, Huber said. The clinic effort might resume when the boosters become available to the general public, Huber said. Currently, booster shots are only being made available for those with moderately to several compromised immune systems or with a doctor's note. Huber said he was pleased that most of the 61 people who were vaccinated at the outdoor clinic this week were seeking their first of two shots. "That 60-plus people who might not have gotten vaccinated if we hadn't offered the clinic," Huber said. Organizers of the outdoor clinic had initially said they planned to keep the clinic open operating for 20 days. Their goal was to administer 6,000 to 10,000 doses of vaccines total, with a goal of 500 vaccines per day. "Our goal was to offer a city service, and we did," Huber said. "It also helped to develop relationships between the city, UTPB, and the county health department, which hasn't always been there. The health department provided the vaccines for the effort, and UTPB provided student nurses and medical students to help with the vaccinations. The city provided fire rescue workers to oversee the clinics, operations, and assist with vaccines. Friends Unite for Children's Books. When Phil Fouch was looking for an illustrator for his Yellow Cat books, he didn't realize it would be one of his closest friends. Fouch, a former Ector County ISD school board member, and Donnie Norwood, a retired educator and IT professor, had known each other for years. Fouch mentioned to someone that he needed an illustrator for a book he was writing. Although they had known each other for years, Phil Fouch, author of The Yellow Cat, didn't know his friend Donnie Norwood could illustrate it for him. Now, the process of publishing the first book is well underway. Fauch said in an email that he has found an El Paso publisher named Jeannie Glenn. The book left the week of September 20th for Missouri to get printed. Fauch hopes to have a book signing somewhere as well. Book 2, Road Trip, will follow, but it has a ways to go, Fauch wrote. The inspiration for I Am Just a Yellow Cat and I Am Jimbo's Yellow Cat were stories he gathered from his friend Jim Blaine at the K-Bar Ranch. Fauch said in a February 2020 Odessa American article that Blaine is a longtime friend and they have done business together over many decades. Norwood said he and Fauch have known each other since the mid-1980s. Fauch called Norwood last summer and said he'd written a book and that Norwood might be interested in illustrating it. Norwood said he asked Fauch to send him what he had written and he would send a couple of illustrations. If Fauch liked them, he would be the illustrator. I did a few and he liked them. He's written 5 books. As he writes them, I just have been illustrating them, Norwood said. They communicate mostly by phone or email. On each page, Fauch will tell Norwood what he had in mind, but leaves it open for suggestions. I've illustrated all 5 books and it's been fun. I was contacted by a lady in El Paso that is interested in me illustrating a book for her, Norwood said. Norwood and his wife Kathy live in Granbury, but he still comes to Odessa fairly regularly. He belongs to a local watercolor club, has been on the board of the West Texas Credit Union for 14 years, and is involved with the Permian Basin Rehab Center. His wife was their development director for many years before retiring about a year and a half ago. Norwood said he and Sonia Haney, an artist, jewelry designer, and retired educator, collaborate on a yearly auction benefiting the rehab center. Since retirement, I've gotten a lot more involved in art. I minored in art in college, but then life gets going. I focused more on my career than art. But now that I have some time, I enjoy it. In fact, we bought a house and one room is specifically devoted to art, Norwood said. He earned a bachelor's degree in elementary education with a minor in art from Hardin-Simmons University, a master's in elementary education from University of Texas Permian Basin, and a doctorate in educational leadership from Texas Tech University. Norwood said he saves his work in a JPEG file and emails it to Fauch. He'll email it back with any changes or says everything looks good. I send him a rough draft of it, then I'll clean it up and make it look a little better. That's the process I've used, and I'll probably do it with the next ones, Norwood said. It's just nice to be doing art that's going to be beneficial to people. A lot of times I do paintings and no one sees them but my wife and I. But being a member of the Watercolor Horizons has been beneficial because it forces you to paint. They meet once a month on a Saturday. I have not been back to paint, but I told them at some point I'll come back on a Saturday and paint with them, Norwood said. His favorite things to paint is portraits. Additionally, Norwood served on the ECISD school board for 5 years after he retired. I just enjoy working with the schools, and I still do. I'm a professor of graduate courses at the University of Phoenix. I supervise, occasionally, future administrators, he said. Norwood said he was pretty excited about the illustration project for a couple of reasons. It was a challenge just to take each page and try to think, what would help a kid interpret what they're saying? What the book's actually doing? Another reason I was kind of excited about doing it was I just put a new program on my iPad and I was anxious to use it. The best way to learn something is to begin using it in a have-to case, and that's what I did. I did all the illustrations in Procreate. It's a drawing program, and it works well. I did the first one, and he liked the first one. Then I just started doing some others. But for me, it was a way to use the new art and actually see some results. It'll be exciting when the books are actually published, Norwood added. Fauch said Norwood is one of those guys that you can always depend on, but quiet. Fauch said the story that stands out most about Norwood is that when he told the publisher he had an illustrator, she asked if he had ever done a book before. When Fouch said no, she expressed skepticism, but he sent her the illustrations and she was pleased. I put about 4 illustrations from him, and she literally 10 minutes later called me and said, "Do not let him go." I said, "What am I missing?" And she said, "Consistency." She said, "Illustrators and books, the pictures from one cat to another, from one person to another, it's really difficult to get them consistent. And I never thought about that." She said he was really good, Fouch said. Fouch went to a gathering with other authors in August and showed one of them Norwood's work. The fellow author jumped on it. "He's so good to work with, and we're friends anyway, and he's really excited about it," Fouch added. "Working with friends doesn't always work, but," Fouch said, "it's made their relationship stronger." "He's just been wonderful," Fouch said. "He is so talented, and I think he really enjoys it. He's as excited as I am about this thing." OHS students honored for academics. 10 Odessa High students found themselves in very select company when they were awarded National Merit and College Board honors. The high school celebrated them with a breakfast September 21st in the OHS Performing Arts Center. Akshuth Mukhera earned National Merit Scholarship semifinalist honors and will continue in the National Merit Scholarship competition. About 16,000 of the 1.5 million students who enter the NMS program qualify as semifinalists. Principal Mauricio Marquez said very few students across the nation have achieved what they have. "So I say that to you because it's about you. You wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for your dedication, your commitment to excellence, coming to school each day, really doing your part when it comes to your academics," Marquez said. "But part of that also is no one does it on their own. Nobody, I don't care who it is, nobody gets to this level on their own," he added. "Love, support, and dedication from loved ones is one of those factors." So Marquez asked the students to say thank you to them. "Sometimes we forget to say those little two words, either thank you or I love you, Mom and Dad, and I appreciate all that you do for me," Marquez added. Mukhera said becoming a National Merit semifinalist is a great opportunity. "I'm really thankful for my teachers from when I was very young, all the way back home in India, and all the way up to this point for motivating me and trying to do my best and to succeed in any way," Mukhera said. The 17-year-old said he has lived in the United States for 11 years. "Both of his parents are doctors," he said. Mukhera didn't speak English when he was small. He said he adjusted through dedication and never giving up. "I used to struggle a lot in English because I was trying to translate between two languages. You just have to put in the hours, put in the reps of trying to understand what you're trying to read and write," he added. Mukhera said he plans to study medicine in college and hopefully join the space program working for NASA or SpaceX. Anastasio Pondo, a 16-year-old junior, won the National Rural and Small Town National Hispanic Dedicated Scholar. Pondo said he was very proud to be recognized in this way. "I'm very grateful for the people who helped me, like my parents and my teachers. I'm just very excited to have gotten this," Pondo added. He said the award will help him be more confident in himself. Pondo said he was surprised to have done as well on the test as he did. "I feel glad that all my parents and my hard work paid off," Pondo said. The College Board offers several other recognition programs that grant academic honors students can include on college and scholarship applications. College use these honors to identify students from underrepresented groups who have excelled on their PSAT, NMSQT, and PSAT 10 or the AP exams and in their classrooms. Those are National Rural and Small Town Designated Scholar Maxine Flores, OHS, National Rural and Small Town National Hispanic Designated Scholar Nisha Bella Carayas, New Tech Odessa, Anastasio Pondo, Elaine Brito, Marissa Rodriguez, Melanie Koss, Rigoberto Mendoza, Sebastian Ramirez, and Viviana Santillan, OHS, Allison Blount, Angel Luna, J.C. Anglin, Joaquin Armendariz, Madeline Ramirez, No Rodriguez, and Nydia Brito, Permian High School. National Rural and Small Town National Hispanic National Indigenous Designated Scholar, Julius Sines, Odessa High School. National Rural and Small Town National Hispanic African American Designated Scholar, Sarah Abera, Permian High School. COVID-19 news by the numbers. COVID in the basin. Ector County, 24,042 total cases, 469 deaths. ECISD daily cases, 13 students, 2 staff. Midland County, 25,218 total cases, 321 deaths. Texas, 3,967,426 total cases, 62,402 deaths. U.S. cases, 42,363,951 total confirmed and 677,068 deaths. Found out more at covidinthebasin.com or on the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTUQ. MCH daily COVID numbers. Medical Center Hospital daily COVID inpatient numbers as of 9 a.m. Wednesday. 74 total COVID patients in-house. Med surge non-critical. 46 COVID patients, 34 unvaccinated, 8 vaccinated, 4 unknown, critical care, 28 COVID patients, 22 on ventilators, 23 unvaccinated, 4 vaccinated, 1 unknown. Of the 22 COVID patients on ventilator, 3 are vaccinated, 18 are unvaccinated, 1 is unknown. Age ranges of COVID patients, 30 to 89 years old. Patients from outside Ector County include 3 from Andrews, 1 from Crane, 2 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Gardendale, 3 from Midland, 1 from Orla, 1 from Presidio, the rest are from Odessa Ector County. Quick hits, Pancake Day. Midland College has scheduled Pancake Day as part of National Pancake Day, all day Friday at the June and Frank Cowden Junior Dining Hall, located on the east side of Scarborough Student Center, Midland College main campus, 3600 North Garfield Street, Midland. Dining hours are from 7 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. and 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Visit midland.edu. Donation barrels. The Oil and Gas Workers Association are in need of relief from Hurricane Ida, in particular Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region. The Medical Center Health System has set up donation barrels outside of the MCHS cafeteria, as well as outside of the MCHS Urgent Cares on West University Boulevard and JVS Parkway. Donation items requested include bottled water, diapers, and non-perishable food items, canned goods. The Oil and Gas Workers Association will then take the donated items, goods, directly to those affected in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region. Live performance. Jason Boland and the Stragglers are scheduled to perform live from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Friday at the Ector Theater, 500 North Texas Avenue. For tickets or more information, visit theector.com. Trade Days. Briar Patch Trade Days has been scheduled from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. October 2nd and from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. October 3rd at the Ector County Coliseum, Building D and E. Admission is free. Visit tinyurl.com/ KXKT4KXS. National Night Out. The Odessa Police Department would like to remind the public to sign up for this year's National Night Out, which is scheduled from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. October 5th. The deadline to sign up is 5 p.m. October 1st. Email the completed registration form to mhamilton@odessa-texas.gov or mail it to 205 North Grant, Odessa, Texas, 79761. You can also drop it off at the OPD front desk. National Night Out is designated to heighten crime and drug prevention awareness, generate support for and participate in local anti-crime partnerships, and send a message to criminals letting them know that neighborhoods are organized and fighting back. In 2008, the National Association of Town Watch, NATW, officially agreed to have a National Night Out for Texas on the first Tuesday of October instead of the traditional first week of August. Visit tinyurl.com/bby27wzk. Free Community Art Day. The LNOL Art Museum of the Permian Basin has scheduled a free community art day, art a la carte, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Saturday. The theme of art a la carte this year is Curiouser and Curiouser, as it ties into the museum's newly opened exhibit, Finding Alice, an illustrated look at Alice's adventures in Wonderland. Kids of all ages will be able to enjoy different art stations and more. Community partners like Odessa High School HARP and UTPB Pots and Prints will also be out at Art a la Carte.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.